so glad to see you well. Overcome them completely silent now with heaven's help. You cast your demons out. And not to pull your halo down around your neck and tug you off your cloud. But I'm more than just a little curious how you're planning to go about making your amends.
Welcome, and we are back with another episode of the Toronto Change Radio Show. Tonight we're going to do something different. Play the first hour of a talk given by Professor Michael Kiefer, recorded July 14th, 2008, reading from excerpts of his article, The Toronto 18 Frame-Up. So we'll just get straight to that. Conclude with a summary after the first section of his talk.
I was in Havana in 2005, where I had the pleasure of hearing Hugo Chavez speak. speaking not merely with the kind of usual rhetorical polish about change, but it's talking about issues of life and death importance. And I found myself drawing comparisons to a figure whom Canadians, I think quite rightly, awarded the accolade of the greatest Canadian ever in that survey that was conducted by CBC several years ago, Tommy Douglas. Maybe we should ask Bob if he'd be interested in taking on the job of Prime Minister here for a little while. We don't have to. Now, with regard, by the way, to that rather sad note that entered toward the end of Bob's talk, when he spoke about, you know, as president, he didn't expect that the interests he was cutting out of the loop, the big financial interests and the insurance companies and the war-making people and the CIA and all that, would tolerate this kind of thing. I thought, you know, it's funny. The standard story about political assassinations on this continent, certainly in the United States, has been what I call the bad Lone Ranger story. Right? The one loopy guy who's acting by himself who does it. And we have a similar kind of fiction, except the numbers were expanded a little bit, for the 9/11 story. Right? Here was the 19 hapless instruments of a bad Lone Ranger who was in a cave in Afghanistan. Think about the Lone Ranger for a moment. Some of you may like me have wanted to be the Lone Ranger as a kid, you know, wear that little powder blue, slightly poncy suit with the buttons down the front and the very tight pants and so on. You remember the name of his sidekick? Tonto. Well, think about that word for a moment. That's not a word out of any Indian language. That's from Spanish. And guess what it means? It means stupid. Now that may be racist, right? It's a pretty the people who invented that obviously knew it. But I'd like to say to anyone who wants to adopt any version of the bad Lone Ranger theory of violent political change, you're welcome to the name of the sidekick. Now, one of the things that I think we want to be thinking about, Bob was giving us, if you like, the macrocosm. He was giving us the big picture. I'm going to be focusing on a local issue. I'm going to be talking about the Toronto 18 frame-up, and my subtitle is Fraud and Fear-Mongering in the, quotation marks, War on Terror. I want to begin with a reminder of the grief and suffering that has been inflicted upon members of our community and on families of this community by these arrests, by this terror mongering, by what I analyze as an instance of state terrorism. Morning, and the fair moon rejoices in the clear and cloudless light for him. empire is no more, and now the lion and wolf shall cease. I think one could say, well, Paul Blake got his prophecy a little bit wrong. He didn't realize the perversions that were going to be inflicted upon the American polity, the manner in which it was going to be twisted and deviated from the original great idea embodied in its Constitution and Bill of Rights. But I present that because one of the recurrent phrases of Paul Bowman's talk that I'd like to try and keep in resonance in this fall was that expression, our values and goodness. Because I think we can take that expression and apply it to what is going on here and now. Is it consonant with our Canadian values and goodness that young men should be fraudulently set up, arrested, subjected to month upon month upon month of solitary confinement, should be subjected immediately after their arrest to what I regard, and what writers on torture unambiguously regard, as torture. Sleep deprivation, that is torture, my friend. And our prison system was deliberately doing it to these men and boys, I think, because they were desperate to try and squeeze something that they could use as evidence out of them in their distress and in their suffering. That is not consonant with our values and our goodness. So I want to remind you, I want to go back into the events now and look at them in some detail. Right? June 2nd, 2006, those arrests resonated around the world. They made headlines everywhere in the international press. The accusations were spectacular. The Toronto police declared that a terrorist cell had been planning bombing attacks against the Houses of Parliament, the CN Tower, the headquarters of CSIS, and the CBC. They intended, after storming the Parliament buildings, to behead Prime Minister Stephen Harper. I think there are many better ways of getting a man out of office. I'd like to look into those. Now, I think any careful reader of the news would notice anomalies at once. One of them being what I think we can only regard as an attempt to scare the daylights out of us. The paramilitary theatrics of the arraignment hearings in the Toronto suburb of Brampton. Snipers on rooftops, helicopters thumping overhead, paramilitary people wearing those scary black ninja costumes and toting big guns and looking kind of scared themselves. The point is that, surely, as transmitted by our media, was to tell us, my goodness, we should be scared as well, because there must be gang upon gang of these people out there ready to descend upon the fortress in kind of Robin Hood style and liberate their terrorist colleagues. So if the guys who dress like ninja, our ninjas are alarmed, if the rest of us should be just gobsmacked with fear. There was a writer in the American website, Buzzflash, who I think caught some of that atmosphere in some verses that he published. He said that, you know, Americans ought to stop being so worried about building a fence along their southern border to keep Mexicans out, given what seemed more urgent problems to the north. And here was this little line. Putting up a Mexican fence may not be the best defense. Let's build one near Toronto and get it finished. Pronto! Now, that's interesting partly because I guess no one told them about the existence of Lake Ontario. You don't need a fence. There was also a bizarre disjunction between the material resources that this fearsome gang of terrorists possessed and what they were supposedly setting out to do. as a sign that this group was intending to emulate what Timothy McVeigh was supposed to have done in Oklahoma City in 1995. Set aside the fact that there's very good evidence that that was an inside job. Yes, McVeigh blew up the truck with ammonium nitrate fuel oil. Brigadier General Parkman of the U.S. Air Force, the top explosives expert, recently retired at that time, wrote a report and distributed it to members of Congress saying, here's how that building was brought down. It was brought down by explosive charges placed on these columns in that Mar-a-Lago Federal Building in Oklahoma City. Set aside that little bit of fakery. The signifier here is homegrown terrorism, because that's what Timothy McVeigh was. Good farm boy, good military record, who just went weirdly wrong and blew up a lot of bases, right? And about 150 adults as well. Now, one small drawback, the group, of course, hadn't actually been in possession of ammonium nitrate itself. There was this bag that the RCMP said in brackets, well, that's a sample. What we allowed them to get hold of was a substitute chemical. So they didn't actually have this stuff. And I'm afraid that if you don't have some fairly complicated technology to mix up ammonium nitrate fuel oil, you can't blow anything up, not even the headquarters of Caesars. Right? It'll make the flowers grow, but it won't make them up. Now, I think our media were asleep on their feet with regard to the clear evidence of entrapment as well. Because the idea of obtaining ammonium nitrate had apparently been suggested to one or more members of this supposed group by Police Momol, who was conveniently an agricultural engineer by profession and therefore could get hold of the stuff. The weapon, as I said, and I know it in your pistol, might belong to another Police Momol, who seems to have been responsible for organizing camping and paintballing expedition into the Ontario countryside that he subsequently represented as having been terrorist training camps. Not that the level of military expertise that he was imparting was, it seems, of all that high quality. Much of the group's time during their major winter training camp in December 2005 seems to have been spent huddling in a Tim Hortons donut shop trying to stay warm. The ways of doing winter camping, he clearly didn't know much about them. And you can add to that little details of the fact that these people were supposedly out to behead the Canadian Prime Minister, whose name they weren't too sure of. Much less, you know, where he could be found. Now, what I'm making here is that the evidence made public at the time of the arrest was pathetic.
Scarlet Pimpernel. No, he was here, he was there, he was everywhere.
carrying out atrocities simultaneously in different places, hopping around on one leg, astounding velocity, escaping truckloads of American pursuers. Now, here's one that's of interest, I think. You'll remember that the revelations about torture in Abu Ghraib came out in the spring of 2004. Exactly a fortnight later, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi had himself videotaped beheading an American, Nicholas Berger. Now, there's some problems with that videotape. Zarqawi, according to all the stories that have been circulating about a month at that time, was one-legged. You know, that was the connection between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. Hussein was said to have had him into one of their hospitals and fixed him up, given him an artificial leg. Well, he was vigorously bipedal. He spoke Arabic without his customary Jordanian accent. The man whom he beheaded was already dead. Now, some of you may have seen that wretched, racist, vile Hollywood film, 300, in which one of the crimes of the Iranian masses who are trying to overwhelm the Spartans, who wear the little leather jock straps, right, and to boil their torsos and so on. One of them is beheaded. And as his father stands there with a kind of, oh no, expression on his face, his sort of magnificent boiled body stands there, headless, doesn't emit a drop of blood. Same thing in this video. I think that scene in 300 was actually a kind of tribute to the Zarqawi video, a snuff video. I think of an equally disgusting performances. The victim is wearing orange prison overalls in the video. The plastic furniture resembles that in photographs of Abu Ghraib. I mean, it's patently obvious with the black operations effort. And it worked, of course, because it allowed the American corporate press to flush the evidence, the clear evidence of Bush, Rumsfeld, Cheney, direct responsibility for torture down the memory hole, and to say, there are the barbarians. Look what they did to one of ours. Now, in the case of the Toronto 18, the beheading motive then strengthened associations with Al-Qaeda and international terrorism by linking the accused with Zarqawi. Although behind the headlines, it turned out that the beheading Stephen Harper was not a crime any of them had actually proposed to carry out, but rather something that an imaginative police officer had speculated in a synopsis of accusations one of them would be likely to want to do. Now, doesn't that sound like a very good reason for having that motif headline in the international press? No criminal charges to that effect were ever laid, by the way. One of the moles, Mr. Mubin Sheikh, helped keep the beheading motif in circulation when he told PBS Frontline that the plans of the accused included storming Parliament, and this was meant, by the way, the provincial Parliament, kidnapping, like holding hostage the MPs, beheading them one by one, unless Canadian troops were pulled out of Afghanistan, etc. So, you know, the story slides and slithers. Are they going to lop off Dalton McGuinty's head, or are they going to lop off Stephen Harper's head? Not true. So, what we have then is an outline of what I'm calling a framing narrative. The Toronto 18 are constructed for us by this narrative as homegrown terrorists, and yet the association with Zarqawi's most sensational supposed crime makes them at the same time barbarous outsiders with spiritual loyalties to the largely mythical Islamist Terror International. By the way, I think it's worth looking at a brilliant book by a Canadian scholar, R.T. Naylor, Satanic Curses, published by the Bill Queen's University Press. He knows a lot about the way Islamic banking and financial systems work, and about the misrepresentation of these systems, and also about what he calls the Al-Qaeda way. fantasies in history. Since it has so little concrete substance, it can and has been transmogrified and transplanted more or less at will to support agendas, many of them ugly, in virtually any and all corners of the world. Now, the entrapment scheme was elaborate, although its elaborateness didn't become visible until sometime after the arrests. Shortly, in fact, in July of the same year, 2006, Principal Governor Moll outed himself, moved in shape, revealed that he'd already been paid $77,000 by the RCMP for his services in setting the group up, and declared that he was owed a further $300,000. He'd served, among other things, as an Army cadet from the ages of 13 to 19 with the Canadian Armed Forces, so the guy had some weapons training. Now, it's interesting, by the way, that we have a publication ban on evidence. And yet, the chief government witness was allowed to go prancing through the halls of the media, doing interviews with PBS, CBC, McLean Magazine, Globe and Mail, you name it. Nobody seems to reject it. So it's okay to have the spin on the evidence made as public as possible. But anything that might serve the cause of defense is going to be kept very distinctly under people's hats. Now, there are two models. The second one was revealed in October 2006, the agricultural engineer. This patriotic Canadian, when he was approached by the Mounties, asked for $50 million for his services. He was paid $4.1 million of our tax money. Now, there's something a little weird about the manner in which the RCMP chose to go to this guy. Because in April 2006, they were hearing from Moomin Shade, apparently, according to Globe and Mail and the Times Magazine, who had it from the horse's mouth, that the terrorist group was experimenting with bomb-making technology, that they'd set a date for their atrocities in November 2006, and they'd select the targets. Now, you think if there were any substance to those allegations, that a normal police force would set about at least thinking about making arrests. What do? They go running off and hire, for $4.1 million with a sense of extreme urgency, an agricultural engineer who can supply ammonium nitrate, who can supply credit cards to buy the stuff with, who can select a warehouse in which it will purportedly be kept, which is conveniently 100 yards away from the RCMP offices in Newmarket, Ontario, etc., etc. The kind of panic involved in this frame-up is transparently obvious. Now, I think it's worth considering, just as a reminder, here we have a terrorist outfit that possesses barbecue tongs and pairs of boots and D-cell batteries, and have seen Reuben Shake's 9mm pistol, and are accused of wanting to make bombs out of the stuff that this other government mole is so conveniently willing to supply them with. What about the timing here? Why was the RCMP so anxious to move when they moved? Now, I think it's worth remembering that the RCMP is both a scandalously corrupt and a scandalously politicized organization. Senior officers of the RCMP ripped off the organization's own pension fund. And they got away with it. The force's politicization was made apparent in its unprecedented intervention in the 2006 federal election campaign. You'll remember, midway through the campaign, the RCMP launched a corruption investigation into the office of Liberal Finance Minister Ralph Hudak. Well, I think up to that time was generally regarded as one of the very few not crooked people in the Liberal cabinet. Goodell and his staff were completely exonerated in February 2007. In the meantime, the polls had swung, Stephen Harper got the election. And I think in gratitude, he made sure that nobody investigated with any care things like the RCMP pension fund scandal. The date. He rests, as it happened, Rubinshake, if you like, was clearly kind of shepherding a group that he had assembled or made to appear as a group at the very least. Whether it was actually a group, I don't know. Shepherding them toward arrest. The RCMP clearly wanted to have a major arrest ahead of the Supreme Court of Canada's scheduled hearing on a case which would be, in which they would be ruling on standards of evidence in terrorism cases. I think we have a clear instance here of the politicized and corrupt RCMP intervening or attempting to intervene in the political and judiciary processes in this country. Now, I think it's worth taking a slightly closer look at the two police moles. Because one of the interesting oddities of this case must be, at least people who are reading the newspaper accounts, what could have induced the parents of Toronto area youth? Some of the kids arrested were 15 when they were rounded up. To permit them to take part in camping and paintballing events organized by Rubinshake. Well, my understanding is that he had some standing in Toronto's Muslim community. He was active in 2005 in that campaign for legitimation by the Ontario government of Sharia family adjudication courts. To the extent that some members of the Muslim community were asking him kindly to desist. He worked at, and perhaps still does at, Masjid al-Nur Mosque as a conflict resolution specialist. He served in Liberal MP Alan Tonks's York South Western Federal Liberal Riding Association as multiculturalism chair. The Riding Association's website notes his training in alternate dispute resolution through the Faculty of Law at the University of Windsor, his interest in comparative religious studies, his response to the conflicts which rage in our world, which was to dedicate himself, and I quote, to interfaith harmony and mutual respect for human rights as the only way forward towards peace and stability in our society. The website also mentions the fact that he served apparently with distinction in the Canadian Army Cadets as a teenager. So I think you have the answer there. If my 15-year-old came to me and said, you know, Dad, I want to go off for this weekend, but, you know, when's your camping? With whom? With a check? Oh, okay. He's a solid man. Although, there are a couple of sentences in Alan Tonks Writing Association website that would, in retrospect, give you pause for reflection. I quote, traveler, philosopher, theologian, Rubinshake is not your ordinary Torontonian. At first look, one might think they've encountered an extremist, but on second take, you realize you've been had. End of quote. I take it that those are his words. So I think we can assume that he encouraged his young associates to make precisely this kind of mistake, for reasons that may have been less pure than the respect for Islamic law and love for his country that he represented to the media as his motives. Because one thing that the Liberal Party website neglects to mention is that his past history includes a significant involvement with hard drugs. As he himself acknowledged to Maclean's magazine in September 2007, he said at that point he had until very recently been a serious cocaine addict. And he said that in his teen years, he was a partier, a pot-smoking tough guy who liked to drop LSD, but quit cold turkey, etc. And then he has this sort of pathetic story of how the pressures of being whole turned him back to drugs. Not to God, mind you. This is a man who made a show of basically taking his religion seriously, and I think tried to, but to drugs. I got back into my old friends, he said, and I started doing shit again. Now, when one looks at the details of the story as filtered through the journalists of Maclean's magazine, there's some things that stand out quite interestingly. Quitting drug use cold turkey doesn't suggest marijuana, LSD use. That's a term that's used for addiction to hard drugs like cocaine or heroin. Doing shit normally refers in drug argo to those drugs. So when he explains his cocaine addiction as resulting from renewed contact with old friends and facilitated his doing shit again, he appears to be confessing to a return to an earlier, probably cocaine addiction. I won't go into detail, but his indications of time, I think, are no more reliable than what you would expect to hear from a serious drug addict. He talks about having become so ill from the drug habit that he had to call for an ambulance on a couple of occasions, and one of his RCMP members eventually checked him into rehabilitation. Now, I would suggest that there may well have been in this case a linkage for him between the two things he was doing with most energy in his teen years, being an army cadet and doing drugs, doing the hard shit. And I would suggest that when he got back into his role as a kind of grown-up army cadet, taking people on camping expeditions and showing them how to pop away with his 9mm pistol and how to march and so on, that he may well have slipped into the related habit at the same time. Now, the addiction, I mention this not to abuse the man, but because I think it raises very serious questions. One of the defense attorneys, Edward Sapiano, has remarked it provides extreme motivation for him to fabricate. A cocaine addict, what does he need? Cocaine. What does he need for cocaine? Money. What's this guy getting from the police? Money. Based on what? The quality and size of his information. So there are very strong reasons then to suspect that the police may well have had their hooks into him already. I mean, if you're doing serious drugs, there's a good chance the cops are going to know about you. And they're going to have something on you. So you will be susceptible to pressures of a kind that the rest of us wouldn't be. And those pressures might include a suggestion that it would be a really useful thing if you could round up a gang or a parent gang of young Muslims who could be represented as a terrorist menace. Now, one or two of the people who were arrested appear to have done irresponsible things or silly things, macho, teenage, young adult things on internet chat forums. You know, wouldn't it be heroic to be a defender of the faith in your act place or whatever, right? Kind of posturing that young men are liable. And I think that alerted the police to possible targets. Move in, here are two of you guys. Go to work on them. I should add as well before moving on that the most hostile observers might be willing to acknowledge that Mundenshake's behavior is marked by a flicker of integrity. He has, for example, maintained that two of the adult suspects, Jamal James and Stephen Chan, ought to be set free. Small recompense, one might say, for long months of imprisonment, much of it in psychologically damaging solitary confinement that they and the other suspects have endured. Not to mention financial losses, loss of reputation. Poll number two. No drug addict, simply a scoundrel. This is a man who bankrupted his parents with irresponsible financial work, it seems. The time he set to work and got his contract for $4.1 million, he was about $200,000 in debt. $20,000 credit card bill. He had failed in an attempt to launch an import-export business. His partner in the plan, and I'm quoting here from McLean's magazine, pulled out, citing his younger partner's tendency to embellish. For example, if you'd ask him how things were going financially, he'd say they're great, but you could see a few days later that he would show the money, the former business partner said. That's just crazy. You've got one witness who's a cocaine addict, you've got one who's a kind of champagne Charlie, who Globe and Mail and McLean's magazine tell us like to sort of oh, there's this great restaurant in Buenos Aires or Warsaw. Let's fly there this weekend. Ooh, they go. It appears that his travel agency was not making money. Now, there's recent evidence that surfaced to indicate that the entrapment was even more elaborate than this, that there may have been a third and possibly even a fourth mole involved. A suspicious man named Kari Kitayapula, who was apparently a source of information about how to do truck bombs. And another man named Talib, who engaged in financial fraud in the Kitchener area. They were never arrested, charged, or even interviewed by police. There's no record, for instance, of the RCMP moving to shut down Talib's ongoing and apparently lucrative bank fraud schemes, according to Thomas Walton and Robert Starr. In other words, we have an elaborate setup that reeks of fraud. And we have, I think, the shameful performance of our corporate media, with some honorable exceptions. I mentioned Thomas Walton, he has done, I think, superb reporting on his arrest. As also has Andrew Mitrovica. One of the things one might have hoped for from our media is some kind of small historical memory. Memory, in this case, of the Project Thread arrests, but only a couple of years earlier. 24 Muslim men rounded up in Toronto on charges of wanting to blow up this, that, and everything in sight. Charges were never actually laid against them. Their reputations were ruined. They were in prison, subjected to all kinds of abuse. 17 of them were deported under conditions that reeked of illegality. Skeptics have quite rightly referred to the Project Thread as Project Threadbare. Now, the prosecution case against the Toronto 18 appears to be collapsing in a parallel manner. In September 2007, having already stayed charges against three of the four juvenile charged in the case, the Crown abruptly halted the preliminary hearing midway through Mubin Sheikh's testimony. That is to say, before he could be cross-examined. And they announced that the case would proceed directly to trial. Thomas Walton noted that defense lawyers were furious. Quote, the whole reason for a preliminary hearing is to determine whether there's enough evidence to warrant trial, and more important, to give the defense a chance to hear the Crown's case. Defense lawyers said they made concessions in return for the right to cross-examine witnesses like Sheikh. Now they won't have a chance to test his widely publicized allegations until the trial. Mid-April 2008, the Crown stayed charges against four of the adult suspects, thus acknowledging that it had no case against them either, although making them sign peace bonds with rigorous curfew and bail conditions. One of the four, Kayum Abdul-Jamal, who was 43 at the time of the arrest, had been represented in court documents as the ringleader of the terrorist group. Proceedings against him turned out to be what he thought they were at the moment of his arrest. He was in a first shock and alarm. He blurted out, "This is a terrible mistake." Well, terrible. But what kind of mistake are we talking about here? It appears we're dealing now not with the Toronto 18, but with the Toronto 11, or if we remember within Sheikh's assistance that another two of the accused, Jamal James and Stephen Chan, are innocent, with what will soon be the Toronto 9. Eight men and a boy were planning to blow up and storm all those buildings and behead all those politicians. Now, Andrew Mitrovica commented in the Toronto Star that the case is imploding. And he's written with scorn of the manner in which the police spokesman just sort of disappeared into the woodwork and left the academic security intellectuals to, or experts to kind of carry the ball. And he remarks that the silence of the police in view of that says much, using his words, about the sorry state of Canada's security intelligence infrastructure and the sometimes incestuous relationship between that powerful and largely anonymous apparatus and some compliant members of the media who regurgitated the state claims allegations and effectively branded these men terrorists. It also speaks, he says, to the need for Ottawa to finally dispense with the tired rhetoric that these security agencies are doing a fine job, and acknowledge the fact that our intelligence service, CSIS, and the RCMP have a long and disagreeable record of falsely accusing citizens of being terrorists.
That was Mike Kiefer speaking at United Church, Monday, July 14th, at the Global Outlook Skeptics Inquiry for Truth event, The 9/11 Deception Continues. That audio was a recording of a video. Apologize that the sound quality is not so good. We're working on that, but that was our live webcam feed, which is still available for a short while on torontochange.com before we get the high quality version up. But we do want to get this information out as quickly as possible, and this particular show is one of many in a series that we'll be doing, looking at the work of Mike Kiefer, looking at the case of the Toronto 18. You know, I watched Glenfiddich Dealings the other night with the Presumption of Innocence Project over at Christie Park, and I'd seen the movie before, but it takes a few times to watch to really have the whole picture come into view and to really see the importance of the issue. And that's why we are, that's why I will be giving this particular story a fair amount of attention. We're really going to flesh out as much as we can and do what we can to see that justice is brought for these young men. And I said that I wanted to recap what we heard. So this is a paper that I wrote couple days after the event, and it was my first impression of what I had heard, and so I'm just going to read what my initial impressions were. What's most disturbing about this particular case, despite the fact that these young men were set up by paid moles, and not entitled to fair due process with the court hearings, but also the level of treatment that these men received in prison. They were locked up in solitary cells, left in isolation under inhumane living conditions, as well as being subjected to beatings. Kiefer asked, "Is it in consonance with our values to have these innocent young men arrested and to be subjected to torture and imprisonment?" Obviously not, but that's exactly what's happening, and hardly anybody is aware of it. There have been a concerted effort in part of the major print media companies like the Globe and Mail and Maclean's Magazine. Kiefer details the narrative frame of in which trumped-up charges and false evidence was presented to the public with a cruel and dehumanizing spin pitted against these young Canadian Muslim men, while evidence in support of their defense was largely ignored. Kiefer then reminds us of the political climate at the time leading up to the arrests and what has been sold to the public on television. Films like 300 depicting the people of Persia as barbarians, while simultaneously in the news, video was released by the CIA of terrorist beheadings of American soldiers. This came at a time when the evidence of torture was torture that was happening at Guantanamo, still is, was initially beginning to surface in the mainstream media. And so these images of dangerous Al-Qaeda barbarian executions were really given a lot of repeated coverage, you know, headline news by the mainstream media as a smokescreen to shift the blame away from the scandalous reports of inhumane policies in Iraq and Afghanistan to the prisoners of war. And it's important that we think about with these warlord parties like the Taliban, these primitive tribes living with Sharia law, living under Sharia law, which is a subject that we can talk about on another show, but it's not new. This has been happening for a long time, but all of a sudden we're outraged in 2006, 2004. All of a sudden it's all over the news and everybody's all indignant about seeing beheadings and you know, people living under repressive law. Well, obviously we should be, but it's just, at the time, everybody's outrage was really just a reaction to what the media was programming into the collective consciousness. And it was, the timing of it, you know, the timing of it coincided with news reports of a new phenomenon, which is CIA black sites practicing cruel and inhumane methods of interrogation on these prisoners of war. Anyways, back in Toronto, the case against the Toronto 18 was very suspicious in and of itself. Their lead witnesses were paid informants like Mubin Shaikh, who was a former cocaine addict. He was paid about $300,000 to infiltrate the group through an internet chat room and lead them into the folds of a fictitious jihadist uprising. The ambush raids on the homes of the Toronto 18 culminated after a weekend camping trip where the men went paintballing in the woods of northern Ontario with Chegg, and this was spun in the media as terrorist guerrilla training. And then Kiefer mentions, ironically, that if these were, you know, real terrorists, would they have stopped by a police station, an OPP police station in northern Ontario, to ask for directions? That would have drawn a lot of visibility to themselves, a lot of awareness to themselves, so, you know, you can't have it both ways. It was alleged by the prosecution that they had intended to bomb major landmarks like the CN Tower and the Parliament buildings with fertilizer bombs, of which the active ingredient for making these weapons would be supplied by another CSIS mole, and interestingly enough, shipped to a warehouse only a block away from another RCMP office in Newmarket. And in every instance, these men were set up as a threat, but in fact were guided along by RCMP and CSIS from the very beginning, without them even being consciously aware of doing anything wrong. So this brings us to the end of the show. We'll obviously be coming back to this issue with more information, looking at different areas in the next show, which I hope to have done before Saturday, but Saturday, Sunday at the very latest, we're going to be looking at the case of Omar Khadr, because a new video just was made available to the public. There is a case happening in court right now to justify the innocence or the allowance of Omar to come back to Canada. So we'll do a show looking at this case in particular. I'll try and dig up some information to really explain, really summarize and boil down all the information you need to know, so that when you come out on Saturday at the U.S. consulate in Toronto, July 26th, you'll have all the information to have a very solid opinion, and to have your opinion voiced. So we'll be looking into that. My name's Darcy, and this has been a broadcast of We Are Change Toronto Radio. You heard it on TorontoChange.com. Thanks again. Thank you.